This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. Sometime in the next few days, the Senate may see a resolution in the bitter impasse over President Bush's judicial nominees. Will it be a compromise forged by moderates from both parties? Will the Democrats back down, or will Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist drop the bomb, unleashing the so-called nuclear option that is changing the Senate rules to prevent the use of filibuster against judicial nominees? As Senate Leaders Frist and Minority Leader Harry Reid describe it, it's a question of procedure and the balance of powers.
In the spirit of civility and with sincere hope for a solution, I make an offer. When a judicial nominee comes to the floor, we will set aside up to 100 hours to debate that nomination. Then the Senate as a whole will speak with an up or down vote.
This is slow motion nuclear option. After 100 hours, the rights of minority are extinguished. This has never been about the length of the debate. This is about constitutional checks and balances.
But ultimately, it's also an argument over the judicial nominees President Bush has sent the Senate.
We have two qualified women. They have met every test. They have shown their intellectual capacity and their fairness on the bench. And these two women should be sitting on the circuit courts of our country and will add a great quality when they have a fair vote.
In my days on this committee, I've never seen a nominee who, in their public utterances and while sitting on a court, expresses such extreme views, views that are truly out of the mainstream of American thought.
Republican Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson of Texas and Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein of California, respectively, commenting on two of the president's more controversial nominees, Justices Priscilla Owen and Janice Rogers Brown. Today we want to step back from the brink and take a hard look at the nominees themselves, as well as the Senate and its rules for approving or refusing justices and how they may change. We'll also talk with a federal judge about how personal values and beliefs do or do not affect decisions on the bench. And of course, we'd like to hear from you. You have questions about the nominees, about what federal judges do, about how their opinions affect their decisions, or about how the Senate makes a decision about whether to confirm or not. Join the conversation. The number here in Washington, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address, totn@npr.org. Later in the show, strange tales from the life of a national park ranger. But first, federal judges and the specter of the nuclear option. To bring us up to the minute on the news from the Senate, we turn to Keith Perrine, a judicial affairs reporter for Congressional Quarterly. Joins us from the Senate gallery. Welcome, Keith.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. What's going on in the Senate right now? I know the negotiations were still underway as early as this afternoon.
Right. Negotiations are continuing behind the scenes, but not between Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist and Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid. Most of the talking right now is happening is being led by Nebraska Democrat Ben Nelson on one side and John McCain, Republican of Arizona, on the other.
And what about in the Senate? There are also some of the maneuvering has begun, I understand, to prepare for the nominations themselves, the first two nominations to reach the floor.
There have been dueling press conferences for quite some time that they've intensified this week. We won't see formal action begin on the Senate floor until tomorrow when Frist goes to one of two nominations, two particular controversial appellate court nominations.
All right, so what's at stake here?
Well, what's at stake is whether a minority of senators can block an appellate court nomination or a Supreme Court nomination.
And is it really about these seven justices, or is the Senate, as we've heard before, looking ahead to a possible replacement for Chief Justice Rehnquist?
Well, it's both of those and beyond. I mean, in the first place, it's about these seven previously filibustered nominees. But for Frist, it's a matter of principle that, as he reads the Constitution, all of a president's judicial nominees, particularly the appellate court and Supreme Court, deserve an up or down vote. People are looking ahead. Everybody expects Rehnquist to retire by the end of June, since he's been ailing with thyroid cancer for many months now. But even more importantly, people are looking ahead to what could be other vacancies in Bush's second term, such as if Justice John Paul Stevens, considered the leader of the court's liberal bloc, or Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who is right in the middle of the high court and really is for all intents, the most influential justice, certainly the most influential associate justice, if she retires, one of those, if Bush names replacements for one of those justices, that would be a battle even more apocalyptic than the one that everybody expects to start this summer over Rehnquist replacement.
And the question is whether or not the minority party, the Democrats, can continue the threat of a filibuster for some of the more controversial nominees. It's been an institution in the Senate for a long time. There are ways, apparently, that the Senate can get around this, and that's what's at stake.
Yes. Now, Republicans will say that never before has have a appellate court nominee been systematically filibustered. But there are a lot of things that have customarily happened in the Senate in the past. For example, for 150 years until the mid-20th century, it took the consent of all senators to vote on a judicial nomination. And since then, we've gotten to the point where it now takes the consent of a 60-vote supermajority. Mm-hmm. But the point being that it's hard to say sort of what's never been the case or what's historic. And Democrats will say, well, President Bush consults with them much less, or really not much at all, on his appointments, much less than past presidents from either party consulted with senators of the opposite party on their judicial picks.
And what makes this feel nuclear, as it's been described, certainly by the Democrats, is the fact that you have the possibility of the Vice President of the United States taking the chair and ruling unconstitutional the filibuster itself or one of the Senate rules. That would be big news, and that's something that appears to be sort of a grand shift, would be a grand shift for the Senate.
It is. What would likely happen is they would stay away from, even though Republicans like to call it the constitutional option, you might not hear that word that much if the parliamentary sequence actually unfolds, because questions of constitutionality have to be put to the whole Senate to decide, and that's debatable. But what will happen, if it happens, is that first we'll make a point of order that a certain number of hours of debate or a certain number of days of debate on an appellate or Supreme Court nominee are sufficient or enough for the senators to decide and then vote. Cheney presumably would be presiding over the Senate then, or at least he'd be on hand to break a tie if needed. He would rule in favor of Frist. Democrats presumably would appeal the ruling of the chair, and that's debatable and thus filibusterable, but if that's a word. But Frist would then move to table the appeal or kill it, and that motion to table the appeal of the ruling is non-debatable and just requires a simple majority to succeed, with Cheney being able to break a tie vote. So if it happens. And when it happens, that's how it'll unfold.
And it looks like either Janice Rogers Brown or Priscilla Owen would be the critical, one of them would be the critical nominee brought to the Senate floor, forcing that option. Why these two?
Well, there are certain advantages. They're both women, of course, and Janice Rogers Brown is an African-American to boot. So they're attractive candidates for the Republicans to force a showdown on. And they seem to be in the mode of wanting to force the showdown because there are other appellate court nominees that the Democrats would allow to be confirmed, but Frist is not putting any of them on the floor. He's choosing to go with Priscilla Owen and Janice Rogers Brown, knowing that certainly the Democrats wouldn't let both of those, the way things stand now, wouldn't let both of those nominees receive up or down votes according to Senate rules as they stand.
And why is that? What's so controversial about them?
Well, in both cases, the critics of Owen and Brown say that their views, both in speeches they might have given, legal articles they've written, and most importantly, their opinions from the bench. Owen right now is a Texas Supreme Court justice. She's nominated to the Fifth Circuit U.S. Appeals Court, and Brown is a California Supreme Court justice nominated to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. The critics say that on their respective state benches, the decisions the two issue and the opinions they write are too far out of the mainstream of American thought. They say Brown, for example, has a view of the federal government, has the wrong view of the federal government's right to regulate interstate commerce or things like the minimum wage or the length of working hours and so on. Now, their supporters, of course, will say that both nominees are well-qualified, principled jurists, who are being unfairly maligned for partisan purposes, and that it's unfair to deny them up or down votes in the full Senate.
All right, so that's a look at a couple of the candidates. Let's take a deeper look now at the procedure in the Senate. Joining us now is Charles Tiefer, a professor of legislation at the University of Baltimore Law School and author of Congressional Practice and Procedure, joins us by phone from his home near Washington. Welcome.
Hi, Frank.
Tell us a little bit, give us a little more detail about this this nuclear option or the constitutional option, whichever you prefer, and how it would work. We heard a few of the details that Keith laid out for us.
Was very good. We'll have probably a couple of days of debate and test votes before we even come to the sort of centerpiece battle. Then there's the point of order. As he says, it will be framed as if you were creating a new procedure. That is, Frist will stand and say after a certain number of hours of debate, a certain kind of nomination should come to a vote. It's a very elaborate, as though the new rule were being written. And then Cheney, in the chair, gives a ruling for Frist. The Democrats appeal. The appeal is tabled. And it's a little vague there. If Frist could have his way, he would then bring matters directly to a vote on a nomination. He may or may not succeed at that point in doing that.
All right, well, what we'll do is we'll take a little break right here, come back and find out how it got to be this way, how the Senate rules developed, and how they changed from the House, which at one time had a filibuster rule of its own. And we'll take your phone calls talking about judicial nominations and the nuclear option. Coming up later in the show, a federal judge will join us to talk about personal politics and judicial decisions. And your questions at 800-989-TALK or TOTN at NPR.org if you want to send us an email. I'm Frank Stacio. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington. As last-minute negotiations continue, the Senate is grinding toward a judicial showdown on two of President Bush's most controversial nominees to the federal bench. Without a compromise, this fight may end with historic limitations on the power of the minority party in the Senate to block judicial nominations and other legislation. Right now, we're looking back on the congressional history of the filibuster and taking your questions about how this power is developed, how it may change in the future. You're invited to join the discussion by calling us at 800-989-TALK or sending us an email at totn@npr.org. Our guest is Charles Tiefer, professor of legislation at the University of Baltimore Law School. Keith Perrine is with us, judicial affairs reporter for Congressional Quarterly. And Charles, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the history of the filibuster and the fact that, tell us, first of all, that the House at one point had this rule and changed it.
That's right. Until 1890, for the first century that the Congress was in existence, in the House, the minority party could and did block action. Indeed, the House minority paralyzed action a lot of the decade leading up to 1890, and then came a great struggle, and the majority party changed the character of the House to what it has been since, quite unlike the Senate. That is, the House does not require consensus, does not allow the minority party to get in the way of the majority's agenda. It functions, as we say, like a machine.
And, well, there are a lot more people in the House, and so you can imagine that that may have been what was behind the instinct to get this change. The Senate works on different operating system, as it were, doesn't it? In a sense, there's more tradition involved than rules of the game, formal rules of the game.
That's exactly right. The Senate has evolved with its limited number of members functioning like a club in the old days, an exclusive men's club, and since then membership opened up. And in the club, the senators, don't either assert their full powers of resistance or obstruction, because that would be undignified and too militant to be a member of the club. And on the other hand, the majority does not bang the gavel and try to obtain machine-like powers. That would also be inconsistent with the nature of a club. A different kind of balance of decorum and dignity in this club-like atmosphere.
And, of course, the filibuster has been used mostly on controversial issues to block the civil rights bill, for instance. And the Senate at that point didn't consider, the majority party didn't consider changing the rules about filibuster, even though this was crucial legislation.
That's right. For about three quarters of a century, the last decade of the 1800s until 1964, the filibuster was first and foremost used to keep civil rights legislation from going through. The last 30 years or so, it has been pretty much available for opposing controversial legislation, whether it's liberals or conservatives. Indeed, the Senate Republicans made vigorous use of the filibuster to when they were in the minority in the first 2 years of the Clinton administration.
We're talking today about judicial nominees and the nuclear option on the program. Charles Tiefer is with us, professor of legislation at the University of Baltimore Law School. And we're going to have to say goodbye to Keith Perrine, judicial affairs reporter for Congressional Quarterly. He's at the Senate, where one of many news conferences are underway to talk about just this thing. Thank you, Keith.
Thank you.
The number to call if you want to join our conversation is 800-989-TALK, and that is what Cy has done from New York. Hello, Cy.
Hi, Mr. Stacio. I guess my question is, I'm frankly confused because there was a piece in the news within the last week or so saying that during the Clinton years, there were 75 judicial appointments blocked by means other than the filibuster procedural rules within Congress. And the Republican leadership has very consistently said, and their position I think someone highlighted earlier in your show, is that a nominee is entitled to an up or down vote. And I don't see how we reconcile those two. If all kinds of procedural rules were used to block people then, how is using any rule inappropriate now under this administration?
Charles, do you have a way to address that?
Cy is pointing out one of those very interesting questions, which you get totally different answers from which side you ask.
Mm-hmm.
If you ask Democrats, they'll say what Cy's estimate is exactly right, that nominees, large numbers of judicial nominees were blocked, and it doesn't matter the details, and there was never a mention that there was some constitutional reason that you had to get an up or down vote. It was simply that you had the use of Senate procedures, and it was tolerated. On the other hand, if you ask Republicans, they'll say that those nominations typically were stuck in committee, and they didn't come to the floor. And therefore, we were not seeing filibustering on the floor. And so there's no precedent from that time period that says that filibustering on the floor has to be allowed. Rather, as the Republicans say, if a nominee is on the floor, a limited amount of debate is the only thing that occurs, and then an up or down vote.
But procedures were used. Thank you for your call, Cy. There are procedures that can be used. And that, I guess, gets back to this question of the Senate as a collegial body full of traditions. Are there other things the Democrats can do even after, you know, the button is pushed to hold things up in the Senate?
There are some things that can be done even on the particular nomination. It's not clear how many such things can be done, because we will be in totally uncharted territory. Once Cheney has made the ruling he's made, we have a sort of right as we go along form of cloture imposed upon judicial nominees, and who knows what can and can't be done under this. Can motions be made to move to a different nominee, for example?
Just to clarify, this word cloture, that is the vote to bring the filibuster to a close.
That's right. For when 60 senators are available, then both parties admit and both parties understand there's a very well-established written rule that says the 60 senators can bring the matter to a vote. But the new thing that's being created, that would be created by this Cheney ruling, this new thing doesn't have a written rule for it. It's what sort of Cheney announces from the chair as we go along. Without 60 votes, with only 51 votes is all that's needed to back it.
And can the Democrats take any of this to court?
Court isn't the way it goes. The way it goes in the Senate is the powers of resistance, because there are, the Senate has this creaky old set of rules, and that functions by the consent of all the senators to let them go by. And if the Democrats are as aroused as they have been saying for a long time they would be, will be, then, for example, they can start saying, well, the rules say every bill that's to be voted on has to be read from beginning to end, so let's set aside 3 days at the beginning of consideration of even the most minor bills to hear them read aloud from beginning to end.
So this could get ugly.
That's why it got the name, the nuclear option.
1-800-989-TALK is the number to call. Ed is on the line from Mountain View, California. Hello, Ed.
Hi. I remember the old films like Jimmy Stewart and standing and speaking to actually a person actually performing that filibuster, and I don't see that today. And I was told that there no one is actually doing that, that it's just a state of filibuster, and I'm wondering, when did it change? Could such a change be rescinded?
Oh, is that true?
That would be productive.
Charles, I thought you really did have to hold the floor. Is that not true?
Well, he's right that you don't, as a practical matter, see the marathons. I think Senator Thurmond held the all-time record of speaking for 24 hours continuously. Technically, you do have to stand and hold the floor. The rule hasn't been changed, and we may see some of that this week. But because the Senate wants to be efficient in its business, it has generally been recognized in, I would say, largely from the 1970s until now, that it's sufficient if you can defeat a cloture petition, if there are more than 40 votes against it, you aren't obliged to stand there for long periods of time to prove you've got what it takes.
All right, Ed, thank you very much for your call.
Bye.
You know, inside the inscrutable black robes of the judiciary are, after all, human beings, and they do have their own political leanings, religious beliefs. They have personal experiences. So we want to know how this cumulative material influences a judge's decision. And we thought we would step behind the bench and talk to Justice Alex Kozinski, of the United States Court of Appeals from the Ninth Circuit, Pasadena Division. Judge Kozinski joins us by phone from his office in Pasadena. Judge Kozinski, welcome.
Pleasure to be here.
How do you separate, or do you separate, your own political beliefs from the rulings you make?
Well, you have to understand that most cases and much of what we deal with is controlled by precedent one way or another. In other words, we have cases on point, and our job is to somewhat mechanically to extrapolate the correct result based on earlier applications of the same rule of law by the Supreme Court or our court.
Well,
so much of the process, it's not the cases that you hear so much about, but most of what we do, we are unanimous on, and whether it be Democrats or Republicans or conservatives or liberals, you reach a unanimous result in the overwhelming number of cases.
But for that popular or well-known minority of cases, certainly your views on the world and the views of your colleagues have to play a role, or this wouldn't be an issue, I suspect, in the Senate today.
I think that's right. I think that's. But it's important to focus on the fact that it is the unusual cases and the cases that are not controlled by precedent, and the ones that really sort of hit home in terms of fundamental values. And there, it seems to me that when there is no controlling authority, a part of what a judge has to look to, you have to look somewhere for guidance. Has to be your own sense of life, your own sense of morality, your own sense of the proper relationship between the state and the individual. For example, I was born in Romania under communism, and I lived there for the first 11 years of my life. And, that left a deep impression on me. It is who I am. When the president knew this when I was nominated, the Senate knew this when I was confirmed. I'm somebody who is highly suspicious of the government, and I am apt to look twice in a situation where I see individual rights being infringed or being compromised. Can I give you an example?
Sure, please do. Yeah.
And again, I don't quite know where the case is now, so I can't make any comment on the substance of it. But we had a case not so long ago that dealt with the question of whether or not the government ought to put certain ought to be able to take the blood of certain people, probationers, parolees, and the like, and put them in the DNA database, type them for DNA, and put them in the DNA database. Now, that was a case that was not controlled by direct authority from the Supreme Court or by anything else, so far as I could tell. And that's a, sort of the kind of case that, for me, properly raised the question of what kind of society do we want to live in? What kind of world do we want to live in? What kind of do we want to live in a world where the government can keep track of individuals and thereby prevent crime? And I think there's a very good reason to say that that this kind of database can be very helpful in preventing crime or in detecting crime. On the other hand, do we want to live in a world where the government can trace where an individual goes from birth to death by picking up little pieces of skin or blood or other sort of DNA traces that we live in our, leave behind, as we move through life.
Right. It could be very intrusive, and that's the challenge.
It could be, and that's the challenge. And I think in cases like that, I don't think we have any choice. In cases like that where there's no law on point and where you're dealing with sort of fundamental values, I don't think you have any choice but to look inside yourself and ask, who am I? What kind of society do we want to live in? And, you know, frankly, you know, this was quite well known when I was appointed. No, it was not a secret that, my background was not a secret.
Well, I just want to remind our listeners that you are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. With me today is Judge Alex Kozinski, United States Court of Appeals from the Ninth Circuit at Pasadena, and also Charles Tiefer, Professor of Legislation at the University of Baltimore Law School. And we're taking your calls this hour as well. Michael's on the line from Salt Lake City. Hello, Michael.
Hello. I was wondering if the Republicans have considered the far-reaching implications of using this nuclear option. There's going to come a time when they're not going to be the majority anymore.
Well, let me put the question a different way to Charles Tiefer, if I may. There is that question about what happens when you change the rules. Has that been a part of why these rules have stayed in place so long? Clearly, the majority party has always suffered under this rule, whatever party happened to be in the majority, and yet they sustained the rule. Is that the reason?
I think that's exactly right. I actually was working for the Senate in 1980 when, after more than 20 years of Democrats being in the majority, you had Republicans in the majority. Since then, it's flipped back and forth and back and forth. But I was there in 1980, and there was great questions. Will they change the rules? Won't they change the rules? And the incoming majority leader, Senator Howard Baker, made no change in the rules whatsoever for the reason asked. He would not want to go back in the minority and be under the foot of the majority, and so he didn't change the rules then.
Let me ask you about something that Judge Kozinski suggested. We do know about the political leanings of these candidates. The Senate's always known this. Have things gotten more fractious and more contentious in the Senate over the past decades? Charles?
In terms of the decades recently, that's absolutely the case. Things have gotten very polarized. You no longer have the figures, particularly a number of Southern Democrats, who went sometimes one way, sometimes the other way, and were very much a moderating influence on the tone in the chamber. Well, on the other hand, if you go back far enough, if you go back before the Civil War, then the senators would sometimes be watching while canes and knives were used to threaten each other. So it's not the most fractious it's ever been in history, but a lot.
But they always played by the rules. The rules of street fighting, anyway. I want to thank you, Charles Tiefer, a professor of legislation at the University of Baltimore Law School, and Judge Alex Kozinski, thank you, United States Court of Appeals from the Ninth Circuit in Pasadena. Thanks to both of you for being on the program.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
When we come back from a short break, a summertime preview, we'll hear about a stranger side of national parks. A national park ranger tells us the tales of living in the parks for 30 years. Stay with us. I'm Frank Stachow. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.